Welcome to this podcast from Adelaide Place Baptist Church. We are a community of disciples, apprentices of Jesus, who live and work in the city of Glasgow, and it's our vision to join God in the renewal of all things. Our discipleship to Jesus is for all of our lives, so as well as listening to this podcast, we'd love for you to join us on a Sunday morning, or get involved in one of our missional communities, which are across the city throughout the week. Our prayer is that you encounter Jesus in some way through this podcast. More information can be found at apbc.net.
Well, hello, good morning. It's great to be back here sharing again this morning. And we're continuing on in our series on the Sermon on the Mount. Just last week, we were in a sort of thorny issue of anger, and this week we are in Matthew 5 again and into a passage which deals with lust. I have given a title for this sermon. I sometimes like to give a bit of attention to that, though not always, and I've called this the Not So Sexy Church. Some of that is maybe just a wee bit of clickbait of just trying to draw you in. It's a line from a book that I've been reading this past week called Redeeming Sex by Deborah Hirsch. It's an excellent book, and I'd encourage people to read that. It's not a particularly theological book. It's a really pastoral, practical book that has real depth to it as well. And she used that as a subtitle in her book, and it's a really helpful one, and to do with some of our theme on lust, I've been drawn on that. But it's also a recognition that when we come to talk about things along this theme, that as the church, we often, when it comes to sexuality, are not always getting it right. And so it's to remind ourselves to be, I guess, a humble posture when we come and we talk about some things. I must say, if I'm being honest, I have a slight wariness when it comes to sermons on this topic, and I was kind of reflecting myself this past week of what's that about. Probably many things, but at least a couple of things in my mind's eye. One, around just the gap, the huge gap between where the church is on issues of sexuality at large and where culture at large in the West is. Now, you might also want to parse out the word huge gap between where churches are within themselves, but also just a huge gap between culture. And safe to say, this passage you've just heard read from Matthew's Gospel is not a hearty endorsement of Love Island or Married at First Sight. It does mention hell. And I don't want to make any connections if you watch those programs, but, you know, I'm just going to leave that there. But recognize there's a huge gap between where culture is at and where Christianity is at on this topic. As well as that, I think there's a slight feeling I'm aware of as we're not gathered here, so it's hard to read each other's responses, body language, but we're all at different stages of life and different experiences. And it's very hard to try and speak in a way that connects with all of those experiences together. So I guess there's a recognition, there's just a challenge that through our different stages and all our backgrounds that we come, that will affect how we come and hear and listen and respond to teaching like this. But nevertheless, with that wariness aside, because Jesus felt comfortable bringing it up right in the middle as he is on the hills teaching his disciples about what it means to enter into the kingdom, to live life for him and with him. And so if it's good enough for Jesus to bring it up and to talk about it with his disciples, well, then it should be good enough for us. And we begin where we left last week by reminding ourselves that Jesus came as he reframes the teaching of the law and draws it to its heart. And he comes as the one who interrupts vicious cycles. He comes as the one who says there's this anger that can lead to, at its worst, murder. And he comes and shows another way. And he breaks the cycle. And in the same way, we come back to this place where Jesus comes in and breaks the vicious cycles that holds us back from being all that God wants us to be. And so I would love us to look at this passage and put ourselves there on the hills as disciples, trying to lean into what Jesus is wanting to say to us this morning. And to do that, just thinking about the nature of the challenge that Jesus addresses, and then trying to really be clear on the type of response that Jesus is inviting his disciples into, and thinking about then, what does that mean for ourselves? So firstly, trying to be there and get the sense of the nature of this topic, of this challenge that Jesus was opening up. And if we just took the passage in isolation, we might wrongly conclude that here we go again, church, God, religion, do's and don'ts when it comes to sexuality. And for some of you, it's already just so predictable. And you maybe can fill in some of the blanks where you think that would go. But I think that would be a mistake to just go and come to that conclusion. But it does seem clear that Jesus was saying there is something serious and potentially serious going on here. Because he says, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. The word that is translated stumble is in the Greek is scandalizo. It's one, Matthew uses a reasonable amount in his gospel. It means to cause, to offend. The ESV, the RSV translated just as to sin. It has this idea, as it rightly the NIV translates it as to stumble. And it's sometimes used by Matthew just as a general, an offense maybe at being offended by someone's teaching. But here, obviously, there is a sense of this stumbling being serious. And though this is not the text to start building your doctrine about the nature of hell, it's strong enough imagery by Jesus to remind us that this sexuality thing is not just, you know, like hunger or food or something like another one of our appetites. Indeed, Jesus is the same as Paul here. Paul in Corinthians goes at great lengths to say, look, this is not just like an issue about like offering food to idols or about food that we ingest. There's a difference about this particular desire and this particular appetite because it's more powerful. And Jesus aligns very much with that. Like sexuality in God's eyes is really significant. It's really important. But I think it's worth saying that I don't think he is saying if you struggle with your sexuality, you're going to go to hell. Because let's be honest then, our benediction this morning should just be good luck and we'll maybe see you again at the end of this. But it is to recognize that it can derail. It has a power. It can derail to the point where you could end up walking away or losing your salvation, your restoration to God. And to me, that doesn't seem as controversial as it might sound, in the sense that I have seen enough people forget about God, and I hopefully, and I pray not forever, over these sorts of things. And I've seen the dynamic in my own heart to know it has a pull and a tug. And it can often lead to, if it doesn't cause people just to walk away from God, it can very often, and maybe more often, lead you to what Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, he referred to as the quiet Christian. Being the one who just has given up on fighting the good fight of faith. They will go along with it outwardly, but inwardly, they've just given up. And it might not be in this issue, it could be a whole range of issues. And they just accept, I'm just going to lead the quiet life I'm going to cause nobody any harm, but inside, there's not a whole lot going on. And that's I've seen that happen and that sort of derailment. So this is powerful. But we recognize that. And Jesus reframes the traditional teaching of the law. And as we've seen the last couple of weeks, he drives it to its heart. He's not light on God's law. But as we learn to read the Bible like Jesus, we realize he's a physician. He's a physician who diagnoses and diagnoses well, and he is bringing the word of God back to its heart, and he's writing it on people's hearts. And he is much more interested, if you read Jesus' teachings in any of the Gospels, between inner and outer congruence. This is what he's going after, not mere outward performance, things looking right and appearing right to other people. So Jesus reframes, but Jesus also unsettles the seemingly comfortable male gaze and immediately is challenging the culture of his day, which was incredibly hierarchical, and their attitude towards women has a lot to answer for. And he does so. Jesus challenges this this male predominance and gaze in his very teaching, and he does so in reference to the Mosaic Law, referring to the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, you shall not commit adultery. And so in diagnosing the nature of the challenge, which is what we're trying to do initially, let's just get as clear as we can on what Jesus connects with adultery. He says, it's anyone who looks at a woman lustfully that has already committed adultery with her in his heart. It does not say anyone who is attracted to a woman or sees beauty in her, or equally any woman who is drawn towards another man, or for that matter, anyone of the same or opposite sex. The attraction is not the slippery slope towards a transgression. But I think we need to be really clear on this. That might sound to some like absolutely stating the obvious. To others, it might actually start to sound a bit reckless. But for me, this side of the whole purity culture that I grew up with, certainly influenced in the early noughties, late 90s by North American, predominantly evangelical culture, I want to draw some really clear and careful demarcations, because attraction is good. Our sexuality is good. And the entire sweep of the Bible celebrates human sexuality from the start. It makes the family line, the seed, babies, a central theme in redemption. And it has its own section in the Bible, a whole book dedicated to human sexuality and its celebration and its expression. And I think if we try and ignore that, or try and dismiss that, try and deny that, or repress that, I think we know always, sooner or later, these things come back to haunt us, come back to hurt us. And Jesus, I don't think, is interested in repression per se, nor is he too prude to talk about some of these things in public with male and female disciples before him. And that's not to exonerate all desires and to say there's no harmful desires in there, but it's just to highlight instead that for Jesus, Jesus calls the problem lust, not a sexual attraction or desire, but lust. Lust is the problem that can derail and can clog up your life. And so the desire here, the lustful desire here, has the sense of taking from that which is forbidden, which is at least one step, probably more, further than finding somebody attractive and moving more towards in the direction of some sort of sexual liaison outside of marriage, and possibly even including a sense of plotting of taking another man's wife with the Ten Commandments in the backdrop of you shall not commit adultery. But it's definitely getting this idea of lust being in complete opposition to the self-giving love that becomes the covenant faithful love that is celebrated from the start to the end of the Bible. And there's the contrast with this is called lust, this idea of taking things for yourselves. I think I came across a definition which just, I find it helpful to hold the balance between some of the good desire and the bad. And somebody has defined lust just as looking for the right things in the wrong places. A number of well-known writers, G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis, have talked at length about vices being more often like virtues gone wrong. Life is more complicated than sometimes just being able to diagnose and dissect. But sometimes there is right desire, good desire, something trying to be expressed. But lust seems to be something about looking for the right things at times in the wrong places. So the nature of the challenge for Jesus is serious. It can wreck our lives. It can throw them off course. It's not to be confused with healthy, growing, certainly adolescence and the desires we should feel. Like, some of us should just recognize there's a natural process in our lives and there's our natural healthy desires. But it's not, I think, as well as we read it today, not just to be limited in our culture to the male gaze, though that is definitely in sight here. But it is about this stark contrast of lust compared to self-giving love. It's that I'm going to steal that and take that for myself that doesn't belong to me. And you can probably use your imagination to see how there's examples left, right, and center of that sort of stealing and taking for self today rather than something about, well, love. So Jesus calls for action. So if that's something of the nature of what we are trying to get our heads around, well, Jesus calls for action. And it's the gouging and the cutting off. It's horrific. I mean, it sounds almost ridiculous to our ears. But this has been and should be taken as, well, don't mess this. We're not messing around here. Jesus is calling for decisive action. He's calling for disciples to not be sitting on the fence here. He's calling for really decisive action when it comes to these issues. Now, there's some bad examples, I think, of decisive action. I think of Origen, one of the church fathers from, I think, the 3rd century. I think I've mentioned him before. He's an incredibly significant writer. He's a prolific writer. He has written so much and he contributed so much to early Christian theology on a whole heap of topics, not least rules around hermeneutics and all sorts of things. Really important guy. But his response in this was to literally do that. He castrated himself. And well, certainly one way of dealing with a problem. He later renounced this and changed his theology. Sadly, I think that was obviously too late for himself, but that was one response that is not to be followed. But I find weird overcorrections today. If there's a sort of repressive purity culture, I find weird responses in some lines today where I see people trying to integrate sexuality and it feels like overcorrection. For example, like women's conferences, just training them and encouraging women how to be glam and sexy for their husband. And they're normally matched with husbands, men on the stage, you know, talking about how smoking hot their wives are. And honestly, part of me is behind the sofa just cringing with what is trying to be said. It just feels so, to me, uncomfortable. I'll leave you to make up your own mind. And of course, there's some more liberal trends of just towards, well, I don't see any lines being drawn and we're throwing off this repression and you know, going to be decisive in all of a direction. I just don't know where it stops. I just don't know where any lines are. I don't know where any boundaries are whatsoever whenever I guess you just dictate desire is king. But I think there's two types of decisive action that are called for from our readings today. And we remember that there's this way we are reading the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus talks about the original teaching at times of the Old Testament law. He reframes it and takes it to its heart. But then the emphasis is that he has the power to break the cycle and he will lead us in practices, redemptive practices, out of trouble. He will lead us in the way of life and he'll lead us in the way of abundant life. This is the life of discipleship, what it means to not just commit, I'm going to be a Christian, I've got somewhere to go when I die, but commit to a life walking, being formed in community with God and with his people. And so the two decisive actions, when we think about our readings today, are about guarding and helping to heal the heart. Guarding and helping to heal the heart. Both of these things are needed. The wisdom literature in the Proverbs calls for this guarding. The heart is fragile. The heart that inside driver of not just our emotions, but including our emotions, the innermost being that loves and drives and longs and orientates our life like this hidden rudder, that needs protected. And Proverbs says, look, guard the heart. And it, don't treat it lightly. It needs protected. It needs something, needs boundaries that just protect it and look after it. And Matthew 5, 2, it has a guarding that is this removal. It's like certainly a removal of some temptation. I think it's more than that. We're about to connect in a second. But there's certainly a guarding response that is required of removing that which can destroy, which can lead away, which can tempt. But then it's also a response of helping the heart heal. It's Jesus will time and time again, as he does in this passage, talk about the heart, this driver. And he wants his work and who he is to get in a deep level. This is where Christianity does its renovation, its secret work. And I think we need to be careful as we challenge systemic injustices of this nature, which there are aplenty. We don't forget Jesus' mode of apprenticeship to him first, that these human systems of injustice are made up by human decisions. And there's a sense of, with Jesus, that he takes his disciples to take ownership for their own contribution towards that and speaks truth to power plenty as well. We've talked a lot about reading in line with the rest of Matthew's gospel throughout so far in the New Testament, that we don't think about this healing of the heart and hear Jesus' teaching as some sort of hard, right? You just got to cut it off and sort yourself out. But we read it in light of the full scope of Matthew's gospel about what Jesus would do. And he's saying, look, he's just talking to these disciples on the hills and he's bringing this issue out to the light. He's getting at the heart of it and saying, look, adultery, you can talk about the extreme out there, but hold on a minute. There's things going on closer to home in your own life. So he's bringing it out into the light. And this is before the cross. So these disciples were listening before the cross. They don't know to the extent to which God would go to express his love for them and the shame that he would bear for them instead of them. But for us, this side of the cross, as we listen and we see this teaching, we can hear the invitation to this decisive call on a whole new level of the one who would go to the cross, the one who would die in our place and show us the extent of his love for us and the way he can carry our shame. This is the sort of healing of the heart, this protection, this relationship that is so secure that becomes a place where the heart, and we've already alluded to it, and Jacqueline so helpfully led us. That word safety is a profound way when it comes to this issue to talk about a gospel of a God who you can feel safe with whenever you feel you're at your worst. And I think that is to say, guarding is needed, the decisive protection is needed, but guarding alone will not be enough. Our hearts are desiring beings, and we need to live by a better story. And the better story here is the one of the self-giving love, the gospel story of faith, of the one who gives us a radical, secure, safe identity in him for us to lead a different life. And how we are grounded in that, then, if for the person who has understood and seen Jesus on the cross and what he did for them. And this story starts to move us in a different direction. However, I think there's two other narratives Christians tend to live by, which I think can be distortions when it comes to a better story to live by that can heal the heart. And I think they have grave faults. One is the romantic marriage story, and the other is the danger story. The romantic marriage story is the idea that, you know, it kind of puts everything on marriage, that marriage is the pinnacle and it is going to complete you and be the resolution to all your problems in your life. We all are aiming towards that. And I just don't see that. I see marriage celebrated in the Bible. and elevated and protected, and it's a beautiful thing. But that's not the better story that we're encouraged primarily to live by. But I also see the danger story aplenty, which is just maybe, in this terminology, the guarding stuff. It's like, it's fear. It's fear of what's going to happen to if we give an inch here, or if we look at this topic, or we talk about this, or explore those desires. It's kind of, I got it in my youth groups growing up, is if you do that, then all hell is going to break loose, and then you do that, and you go, well, it doesn't really, so. And it's just, we just tell danger stories to try and hem people in. Well, I think that the physical expression of our sexuality from a Christian point of view belongs in marriage. And for me, and I realize it's a contested issue, I think, between a man and a woman. However, faith in Jesus does not require you to be fulfilled in marriage. But the claim of Christ on your life is that he can satisfy you that, and then he places you into his body, which is a community, which is the church, to help propel you to live a life of abundance. And it's faith that produces love for God and for neighbor. And as we get lost in the community of that story, of living out faithfulness to God in that story, and lives that are dedicated for other people, we suddenly realize how cheap lust is. Because lust just takes. Lust just wants what you want and just wants to always steal. And so we're looking for faith-driven, decisive action, not fear-driven action. This, I think, is what is called for in this passage that guards and helps to heal the heart. And faith, which is trust that Jesus liberates and reorders and heals and helps us just go in the right direction. Faith is not, I can get to that mountain and I've measured it and I've trained and I reckon I can get there. That's not the faith that is called for here. The faith here is this trust that's like, I can't get there. I just cannot get to that place. It's impossible. But I trust somebody who can help me get there, who can walk with me. That's the sort of decisive response you're being called into. It's not just pull up your bootstraps and deal with it. You're being drawn into the story of the one who deeply loves us and is leading us to a better place, and a better place to stand, and that we can only get there in light of who Jesus is. So the nature of the problem, the decisive action, guarding, and this heart needs healed. So what does faith-driven decisive action look like for us today? What does guarding and helping hearts to heal look like today? Well, I think when it comes to our mission, our sense of reaching out, God, you know, connecting with a world, I think acknowledging our need for Jesus in this area is a good thing for our mission and not a bad. Which is to say, acknowledging that we have struggles and we have sexual brokenness and confusion, acknowledging that helps us identify with the world. And I hope it helps the world identify with us. Not the sort of sweeping Calvary coming of the puritanical ones who have figured this out. Sometimes I think, and there's balance, I guess, in saying that, but sometimes I think we put a barrier whenever we are not able to be identified with this. And I think for our mission, that is something really significant. When it comes to parenting, well, a guarding and helping little hearts understand their sexuality is incredibly challenging and important. I've got three boys. I feel the need to guard. It's, you know, to say there's fear-driven response is one thing, but it's also to say at times there are genuine fears. It's not to dismiss genuine challenges when it comes to a world out there, particularly when we think about the online world that is so accessible. Lines do need to be drawn and explained. And every parent is wrestling with what that looks like at age-appropriate ways to guard. They have a responsibility to guard and to look after and protect little fragile hearts before they have wounds that hold them back in their life. But they also need to help the little hearts, because as any parent will know when they're really honest, is that we can guard all we want, and we will, but, well, there's always the lowest common denominator of, well, their best friend and the different rules in a different house. And there's a limit to guarding, and it's why we also need to allow the heart to be touched, to be expressed. Little hearts need to understand their sexuality. They need modeling of healthy relationships, male and female. They need educated. They need prayer. And they need grace, just like you and I need grace. Guarding and healing. Parenting. Single, divorced, widowed. If sexuality is a gift, it's how we're made, that leads us out of ourselves, then this can be expressed in a healthy way. We can have mature conversations with each other. We can try and understand ourselves and each other better and parse out legitimate desires from those that are unhealthy and unhelpful. And if Jesus is leading this little Bible study in the hills with men and women before us and happy to talk about these things, well, maybe all the more in our discipleship, we should be good at talking about these things, about legitimate desires and legitimate struggles that we may have. For couples married 1 year to married, well, I was going to say 400, but I guess that's not a thing. But, you know, there's a whole spectrum of where we're at in our married lives and that journey. And again, some of us just need release from the romantic view of marriage that is, you know, Instagram friendly and it's all leading with our best foot. And actually just construct something more positive and more robust and be recognized in marriage. You know, it's about being as committed to a relationship around laundry and cleaning and putting out the bin and sex. Those things are actually more deeply connected than you can ever understand in a marriage. It's not all glossy. It's people giving of each other. And I guess even in marriage, there's a guarding and a helping hearts. We're not having fear-driven conversations of allowing problems to, by not talking about them, to turn into this huge thing. And also, sometimes we need to remind ourselves, not just what we're against, but what we're committing for. What we're, as couples, what we're for, what we said in our vows we would do, is to give of ourselves wholly to the other person in that mutual way. And we prioritize that. We prioritize building affection on all the levels, physical and putting out the bins, which is not my job, by the way, in our house, the bins. And we acknowledge issues. We're confident in them. Not that we can get ourselves to the top, but that Jesus, when we place Jesus at the core, he heals. He helps get past things, because there's no such thing as a perfect marriage. I think sometimes young people look, I think we know this, but there's no such thing as a perfect marriage. Marriages need grace. Every day they need grace. And how much do they need grace in this season that we're in? And plus as well, for some of us at times, we will just feel stuck. And there's something here, I think, about decisive action, about getting outside help when you get stuck. Normal, this should be just normal, where we just recognize, you know what? I cannot just keep pulling up my bootstraps and sort myself out. I feel stuck and I need help, and I'm going to ask for help. I asked one of my friends who was a young woman who went through student ministry when Claire and I were involved in leading the student ministry. Her name's Bethany. She works for a charity called Naked Truth, which is a great Christian charity that tries to educate and release and transform people in the world against pornography. And so it's got so many practical resources. And I asked Bethany, I said, look, I realize I'm talking from a perspective here this morning that will probably connect with, I don't know, two people. But so just help, what does this passage bring up for you as someone who's had battles, particularly through uni, with struggling with pornography and now working for this charity? And she said this, and I quote her word for word. She said, I remember reading this passage when struggling and thinking, oh great, so I should just chop off my arm then. And the enemy made me feel so ashamed. But having been caught up in the absolute depths of porn and lust for over a decade and knowing true freedom now, I realize that this passage is love. Jesus is saying, lust is horrible, wicked, painful, and powerful. Get rid of it. Chop it out. Seek help. For me, the intentional steps we need to take are away from shame and darkness towards vulnerability and light. Lust thrives in the darkness, and so we have to thrust it into the light. Bethany also made a helpful comment, I thought, on the value of people who aren't particularly in a community stuck in issues like I've just described, because they become incredibly significant people to start modeling a life that is different, a life of freedom. And so for some of it, you might be tempted to think this has nothing to do with me whatsoever. I suspect that's not the case, though, for many. But there's a wonderful reminder that actually, if something that we feel we've grown through, we've got yards and experience on the good side, that can be a real gift as we help one another. And as I finished here this morning, I had this random picture that came from my Instagram feed. I've fallen lots of running stuff on Instagram at the minute, just to help motivate me since I've started running through lockdown. And there's just this image came up of, it's a video, it was a reel of a runner finishing a marathon. And he was coming down the last 50 yards towards the finish line, and his legs had completely gone from him, and he was literally all over the place, like falling over, just like I've perfectly demonstrated for you. And he was getting to the finish line, and he basically, I don't know why, but these things just, it almost can bring me to tears on an emotional level. I just love sport, maybe that's just the conclusion, and anyway. And he was running towards the finish line, and you should have seen the picture. The crowds were lined either side of him and cheering like mad because his legs are gone, and they knew it. And they were thinking, like, and he got dragged over the finish line. The crowds were like screaming and battering the side and saying, come on, come on, come on. And then he makes it over the line. And I think there's something here that reminds me of this and what Bethany was saying, of an invitation to the disciples of Jesus as we place ourselves there on the hill. We are invited into this safety that we've talked about, this community that you'll find that God is for you, not against you. And as a community, there's no sense of bringing things of shame into the light to be shamed more. We get brought into the one who breaks the cycle, and we find a community who will be for us and find appropriate ways to say, come on and cheer and say, look, God can take you on in a great place. And God is the one who can heal our hearts. So if your legs are gone, and if you feel you're beyond it, you feel stuck, if you feel overwhelmed, I think there's something of symbolism in that image of here, of the upside down people of God, people who feel like the rejected ones, the ones that don't deserve it, God putting things right and saying, no, come on in. Because with Jesus, he breaks the cycle and he leads you into a different place. Little by little, some dramatically, without us really understanding how at times, but he calls for that faith, that decisive response to trust in Jesus. What is going to, for you and I, to be the decisive response of placing our trust in him today? May that be something that brings hope, peace, safety, and security in a difficult, difficult moment of time. Let's pray. Spirit of God, we need you. We need you to take us on a journey. We need you to lead us in a process that helps our hearts heal. We need you to give us wisdom to know how to guard and protect. We need clarity to be decisive. We need courage And we need to our hearts again to be wooed by a God who is for us and can satisfy us in the, to the very depths of our being. I'm just going to pause for a moment, and in your home, in the quiet of your heart, or if you want to shout out in your room, make a response to Jesus today that says, I trust you and I want to live for you. For the first time or the 100th time, or picking yourself up again, your legs are gone, we say, Jesus, I live for you and I'm for you because I know that you're for me. And if you're for us, God, nothing can get in the way of that love that you have for us. Father, I pray for those who at times just feel this, the sin that clings has diminished our sense of well-being, our sense of identity, our sense of worth before you. Speak love, speak hope, speak worth, and speak new life in the God who is for us, in Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.